For more than three decades, NASA's Voyager spacecraft has traveled some 11 billion miles to reach the outskirts of our solar system. It's the farthest man-made object from the Earth. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this hour is University of Iowa research scientist and engineer Bill Kurth. Kurth will tell us about his work on the Voyager missions and several other probes he's been involved with. We'll also be joined by Roger Lonius of the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. We'll talk about American support for space missions and the challenges and objectives of future space exploration. First, this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. 36 years after it blasted off from Florida, the Voyager spacecraft has officially entered interstellar space. That's a cold region where particles from our sun stop and the remnants of ancient exploded stars begin. Here to tell us more about the significance of this milestone, Bill Kurth is with us, University of Iowa research scientist in the Department of Physics and Astronomy. He is currently a co-investigator on Voyager's plasma wave instrument. He's involved in a lot of different spacecrafts and probes, including Galileo, Cassini, Juno. We'll hear about those this half hour as well. First of all, welcome to Bill Kurth.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk about the Voyager making news within the last few days. First of all, for years, you and your fellow scientists have been eagerly awaiting for Voyager 1. And there were two of them. There are two, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, to become the first human-made object to enter interstellar space. And we've heard that's happened. How do we know?
Well, it's been a puzzle, actually. The first indications that we crossed this boundary, we call it the heliopause. It's the boundary around the heliosphere, which you might think of as a huge bubble in space that's filled with plasmas that come from the sun. A little bit more than a year ago, particle detectors on the Voyager 1 spacecraft that measure galactic cosmic rays. These are the highest energy particles in the galaxy. They jumped up to a level that had never been measured before. Energetic particles that are generated inside this heliosphere within the solar wind went away. And that was a clue that something had happened. We don't have an operable plasma instrument on board Voyager 1. There's one on Voyager 2 that's still working well. But without understanding what the density of the colder plasma is, we couldn't really say that we had crossed this boundary we call the heliopause. We thought maybe we could look at the magnetic fields. A lot of people, including myself, thought they would have changed directions when we crossed this boundary, but they didn't. So there is a puzzle. Over the last year, the Iowa instrument on Voyager, the plasma wave instrument, detected on two occasions what we call electron plasma oscillations. This is a special mode of vibration in the plasma where the electrons vibrate relative to the ions that cause waves that we can detect with Voyager. And those waves tell us by their frequency how dense the electrons are in that plasma. And it was a density of about 0.1 per cubic centimeter. That's about one particle per cubic inch. And that's the density that we expected to measure in the interstellar medium.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we have a little bit of sound, of first ever sounds captured from interstellar space by Voyager 1 in this case. It's a short clip that we have, 10 or 12 seconds. Describe what we're going to hear.
Okay, so the frequencies you're going to hear are exactly the frequencies that Voyager detected. And the frequencies of these tones, as I said, tell us what the density of plasma is in the interstellar medium. But we've compressed the time This is about a 7-month period. You'll hear a tone at somewhat lower frequencies early on that'll last for a couple seconds, and then there'll be a gap, and you'll hear what I guess most people would call tape hiss, although that's not really what it is. And then there'll be a somewhat stronger, higher frequency tone towards the end of the clip.
Okay. Audio captured over the course of many months and analyzed earlier this year by Voyager 1 in interstellar space. Let's listen. Okay, that was the extent of the sound there. I thought there was going to be a little bit more, but we heard that. Tell us how far Voyager is away from the Earth, because we hear the number 11 billion miles, perhaps 12 billion miles. That's hard for us to fathom. Can you help us begin to fathom such a distance?
Well, I have trouble myself. Numbers that large, I think, are hard for anybody to comprehend. And so we use a different unit of measure to talk about where the Voyagers are. We talk about astronomical units. That sounds like a fancy term, but it's basically just the average distance between the sun and the Earth.
Okay.
That's one astronomical unit, or one AU. Voyager 1 is currently beyond 125 AU. That means it's 125 times further from the sun than we are here at Earth. Voyager 2 is a bit beyond 100 AU. I think it's about 103 AU now. One way to think about that is if you've ever listened to a news report where the reporters are on the other side of the Earth and they're talking over the phone to somebody on the other side of the Earth and they're using a satellite link to talk to them, there's always this pause.
That's slight delay. Mm-hmm.
It's a slight delay. And that's because the speed of light or the speed of the radio waves going from the reporter to the satellite and then back down to the studio takes on the order of a half second or so. And so you can actually hear how long it takes the radio waves to travel that distance. It takes 8 minutes for the light that leaves the sun to reach Earth. So that means that the radio waves that are sent back from Voyager, sending the data that we look at every day, takes over 17 hours to come all the way from the spacecraft to the receiving stations on Earth.
Traveling at the speed of light.
Traveling at the speed of light. So everybody's heard the term a light year. A light year is how far light travels in a year. And Voyager is almost 3/4 of a light day from us right now.
Mm-hmm. And that is far more distant than Pluto.
Oh, yes. Right.
Pluto's
about 40 astronomical units.
Okay, so 3 or 4 times the distance
right.
from the Earth as the most distant planet, though I guess Pluto was demoted recently. But that's not the topic of our discussion today. To be clear, because I think some press accounts actually get this wrong, we're saying that Voyager 1 has entered to interstellar space, but are we saying that it has left the solar system?
No, the solar system, and I think a lot of people are confused by this. In fact, I think I misspoke one time a number of years ago and talked about the heliopause being the edge of the solar system. But there's a cloud of comets that encircle the Earth, or I'm sorry, the sun, at very, very large distances, well beyond where Voyager is. Voyager will have to go probably another 30,000 years or so, 3,000 years or so before it leaves the Oort cloud. The Oort cloud is a cloud of comets that are gravitationally attracted to the sun. They're in orbit around the sun, and therefore they're part of our solar system. So it turns out that actually most of our solar system is in interstellar space. And this bubble that we're in, the heliosphere, occupied by gases that come from the sun, is actually a very small volume compared to what technically one would call the solar system.
If you've just joined us, Bill Kurth is my guest, University of Iowa research scientist in the Department of Physics and Astronomy. And he has worked with Voyager over three decades, and we're talking about the fact that Voyager now recently entered interstellar space. Bill Kurth has been involved with a number of other spacecraft and probes that we'll hopefully talk about too. But if you have a question about the Voyager missions, the nature of interstellar space, space exploration, 1-866-780-9100. river2river@iowapublicradio.org, our email. We're also on Facebook, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. Do you have a good idea of what the space around Voyager is like right now? It's so distant. For instance, if there was a porthole in the craft and it was a manned craft, what would you see? What would our sun look like from that distance?
Well, the sun would be the brightest star in the sky, but it would look more like a bright star than the sun we're used to seeing. The intensity of sunlight that comes from the sun drops off as the square of the distance. So, for example, at Jupiter, which is five times further from the sun than we are, Jupiter only receives 1/25th the amount of light that we do from the sun. So, at Voyager, the sunlight is divided by 125 divided by 125. So that's a very tiny amount. It's very dark out there.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a little bit more audio that Voyager picked up quite a while ago. You mentioned Jupiter. We have some audio of Voyager 1 approaching the sonic boom or bow shock of Jupiter. Before we listen to this 10 seconds of audio, tell us, what is the sonic boom and bow shock of Jupiter? Voyager visited, four planets? Did it flybys of four planets?
Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. Both Voyager spacecraft did Jupiter and Saturn, and Voyager 2 went on to Uranus and Neptune.
So we're going to hear some chirping. What is this?
Right. Okay, so the solar wind that I've mentioned is actually plasma that comes from the sun. It gets accelerated because of its temperature to speeds of 1,000,000 miles per hour. And that wind blows past all of the planets out to Neptune and, in fact, out to a distance of about 94 astronomical units before it slows down. And just as an aircraft flying through our atmosphere at supersonic speeds will cause a sonic boom, the fact that this solar wind is moving at supersonic speeds past the planets means the planets have a sonic boom in front of them. And as Voyager 1 approached Jupiter, we heard chirping, which has to do with beams of electrons coming from this shock. It's exactly the same mechanism that caused the sounds that we heard in the interstellar medium. And then they quiet down and we hear this crescendo of waves that is actually the sonic boom surrounding Jupiter.
Okay, let's listen to this audio from Voyager 1 approaching the sonic boom or bow shock of Jupiter. Okay, a short bit of audio there. It's amazing to hear from you what you can glean from that bit of audio, but you have more information than just the audio, obviously.
Yes. Well, we look at the frequency of the waves, we look at their intensity, and we look at their time variation. The chirps that I mentioned ahead of that shock are, again, plasma oscillations, and their frequency tells us what the density of the plasma is around the vicinity of Jupiter, not outside of its magnetic bubble.
Okay, let's Bill Kurth, my guest, University of Iowa research scientist in the Department of Physics and Astronomy, has been involved for many decades with the Voyager mission. Let's go to our first caller. Josh called 1-866-780-9100. Your questions about the Voyager mission and the nature of interstellar space, space exploration. Josh, welcome to our program. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I'm curious about how the Voyager missions have gotten so far out into interstellar space and they've not run into anything like anything. I mean, no astro. I mean, how does that happen? How does it get so far away without like getting into a car accident or whatever you want to call it?
Good question, Josh.
That is a good question. And actually, both Voyager spacecraft have actually run into a lot of material. I'll talk about that. Hasn't caused any damage so far. But the expanse of space, it's just incredible to think about how much empty space there is, or space without rocks or planets or comets or whatever. Between the planets and between the stars. It's a very empty place. There was concern when the first spacecraft went through the asteroid belt that they might not make it, but we've sent numerous spacecraft through the asteroid belt. None of them's come anywhere close as far as we know.
Mm-hmm. You talked about some collisions, though. Were these minute particles? Or?
These are minute particles. Voyager 2, for example, went through the ring plane of Saturn, not through the rings itself, but through the what we thought was a clear zone outside of the rings. And we were bombarded with something like 500 impacts per second hitting the spacecraft. Now, these particles, we call them micron-sized. They're about the size of a cigarette smoke particle. But they're moving so fast that when they hit the spacecraft, they vaporize themselves and a minute part of the spacecraft itself. And that causes a disturbance around the spacecraft that we can detect with the plasma wave instrument.
Fascinating. Josh, thank you for that great question from Davenport.
Right, thank you.
Right. Dave is with us from Des Moines. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Great program today. I don't know anything about space, but I'm really interested in it. I was wondering what kind of speeds is the Voyager spacecraft traveling at this time?
It's moving at 38,000 miles per hour. And again, backing off to somewhat smaller numbers that I can think about a little bit more easily, that translates to a little under 3.6 astronomical units per year. So every year, Voyager 1 moves out at a distance of 3.6 astronomical units.
Okay, Dave, thank you. And I think you have, Steve, in Clive, you have a related question. Welcome.
Hi. I do. How are the Voyager crafts propelled? What's the propulsion mechanism?
They were launched with what was our most capable rocket back in 1977. It was called a Titan 3E with a Centaur upper stage. And beyond that, there have been very few propulsive maneuvers by the spacecraft itself. There are small trajectory changes that don't take a lot of propulsion. But the Voyager mission was designed around the fact that about every 175 or 180 years, the outer planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, are arranged in such a way that you can do gravitational assist flybys past each one successively and use the gravity of each of those, or the orbital motion actually of each of those planets, to add energy to the spacecraft itself. And we got to Neptune in a total of about 12 years. If you didn't have any gravitational assist, that same rocket would have taken us 30 years to get to Neptune.
Mm-hmm. Were there any miscalculations along the way with either Voyager 1 or Voyager 2, or did everything just happen spot on as far as slingshotting it out of the toward interstellar space?
The navigators are just amazing, as far as I can tell. I don't think, and I've had experience not only on Voyager, but Galileo and Cassini. Cassini executes a close flyby of the moon Titan every few weeks, and we've never missed a one, as far as I know, knock on wood. The people that fly these spacecraft really know what they're doing, and they're very careful about what they do. They check their calculations over and over again. They've got processes to make sure they don't make oopses.
This is an email from Charlie for you, Bill Kurth. He says it was great to hear you and your colleague, Professor Don Garnett, last night. Evidently, there was a big gathering in Iowa City. You had a large audience to talk about this milestone.
Yeah, we packed the house in Lecture Room 1 in Van Allen Hall, which is our largest lecture room. And
hundreds of people then.
Yeah, I don't really know what the capacity is, and the fire marshal may not want to know how many were there.
But anyway, an enthusiastic crowd, and you and Professor Garnett got a standing ovation.
I understand. Yeah, it's the first time for me. I think that's the second time for him, but...
Charlie's email goes on to say, it seems incredibly lucky that Voyager 1 headed toward the nearest part of the heliopause. Was the solar system's motion known during the early years of the mission?
Actually, yes, it was. The fact that we went towards the nose was a result of this planetary alignment that I talked about.
So it's kind of an oblong thing, and it's not perfectly circular centered on the
well,
sun.
Well, think about a windsock, and think about the wind blowing from the west, and the windsock tail is extended out to the east. That's what we think this heliospheric bubble looks like. I should say that, you know, Pioneer 10 and 11 were also on escape trajectories from the sun, and Pioneer 10 was going in more or less the opposite direction as Voyager 1 and 2.
So you knew this was going to be the nearest part of the heliopause?
Yes, that's what we expected.
We have just a couple minutes before we take a break, but give us an account of Voyager 1's greatest accomplishments to date.
Well, I think you have to start by realizing that Voyager, both the Voyagers, gave us our first detailed looks at the outer planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. We've had follow-on missions, Galileo to Jupiter and Cassini to Saturn, that have supplanted them in terms of providing more higher resolution images and so on. But Voyager really wrote the textbook on the outer planets of our solar system. We discovered at Jupiter, for example, that one of the Galilean satellites, one of the satellites that Galileo discovered with his telescope, actually is the most volcanically active body in the solar system. There were 8 or 9 volcanoes going off when Voyager 1 passed. We've discovered geysers on the moon Triton at Neptune, which is astounding, understanding that the temperatures of that moon have to be something like 40 degrees above absolute zero, yet there's enough energy inside that moon from whatever source that we can drive geysers. Mm-hmm. We've detected lightning on other planets, Jupiter, and that was a discovery made in part by the University of Iowa instrument.
Okay, Bill Kurth will stay with us on into the second half hour, and we'll begin talking about not only Voyager, but some of the other missions. Galileo, Cassini, Juno. Also will be joined by Roger Lonius. He is with the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. He'll join us by phone. We want to talk about the future of space exploration, also including funding for it. Perhaps you have questions. For instance, what would you like to have NASA set its sights on for the next 5, 10, or 20 years as we hear these conversations about what things are many light hours away from us, as Voyager is. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. Back more with Interstellar Space. We're out in interstellar space on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's 36 years after it blasted off from Florida in 1977. The Voyager 1 spacecraft officially entering interstellar space, and we're talking about that with Bill Kurth, a University of Iowa research scientist in the Department of Physics and Astronomy. He's been involved with Voyager for his entire career, and if you'd like to join our conversation with your questions about the Voyager mission, the nature of interstellar space, space exploration, what would you like to have NASA set its sights on for the next 5 to 20 years? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. In just a moment, we'll be joined by Roger Lonius. He's with the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. Before we go to Roger, let's finish up, Bill, with a few other things, because Voyager has been a large part of your career and your energy. But let's talk about some of the related things you've been working on. A couple of other notable missions. Galileo launched in 1989. What was its mission, and what's it been doing in the meantime?
Well, NASA had a plan, still has a plan, actually, to study the outer planets. Voyager was the reconnaissance mission. It flew by each of the gas giant planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and it didn't go into orbit at any of those. It whizzed past very quickly, but gave us an opportunity to find out what was there. Opened new vistas on what all of the moons that orbit those planets look like and what they might be made of and so on. The Voyager mission was then designed to be followed up by probes that would provide more in-depth studies of those bodies. Galileo, for example, was launched to go into Jupiter's orbit, and it stayed in orbit for a number of years. And it provided very detailed information about that planetary system flying by many of the Galilean satellites. And in fact, one of its major discoveries was that the moon Europa has a crust maybe 10 or 20 miles thick of ice, but below that we think there is an ocean. So here's liquid water in the outer solar system, and those who think they want to look for evidence of life elsewhere in the solar system, first thing they do is they try to find where's the liquid water. And so Europa is one of those places. Another mission that I'm involved with is currently going on at Saturn. It's the Cassini mission. It was launched in 1997, arrived at Saturn in 2004, and it continues to orbit Saturn. We hope it'll continue to do that until 2017. And just like Galileo at Jupiter, Cassini has been opening our eyes to a lot of the things about the Saturnian system that we didn't understand. We now have cameras and radar systems that can look through the very dense atmosphere on Titan. This is a very large moon in the solar system. It has a nitrogen atmosphere that's 50% times more dense than our own. And it has lakes of liquid ethane and propane on it. Because it's so cold, the water there is frozen. And just like at Jupiter, we've discovered that one of the smaller moons at Saturn is a source, perhaps, of liquid water. There are geysers that are emanating from the south pole of the small moon Enceladus. And so here's evidence that there must be liquid water somewhere beneath the surface of that moon.
Mm, fascinating. Let's go back to our callers. Mike is with us from Des Moines. Hi, Mike.
Hi there. Question related to helping someone like myself understand over these years of research, what is it we the citizens should understand has been the residual benefits of what we've learned and what we expect to learn? How does this impact my life? What has happened from this research and knowledge we've gained that we can say we wouldn't have this happening in our society, we wouldn't have these things going, that can be attributed to this investment in research and exploration out there?
Mike, thank you very much from Des Moines.
Well, I think the best answer to that question is that the space program, as a lot of science and other fields does, tells us more about who we are, where we came from, and where we're going. Study of the outer planets, for example, Jupiter in particular, tells us about the origins of the planets in the solar system. Jupiter contains more mass than the rest of the planets put together. If you want to understand the origin of Earth, where we came from, you have to understand the origins of Jupiter itself. And I think, well, I had a friend tell me one time about being at a dinner with an Israeli scientist and a Russian scientist. This sounds like a joke, but it's not. The Russian scientist asked the Israeli scientist, you study the moons of Jupiter. How does your government, in a country that's surrounded by all sides by enemies, have funding to give you to study the moons of Jupiter? And his answer was very simple. He said that our government believes that we don't have anything to defend if we don't pursue the arts and sciences. Hmm. So I think that's a satisfactory answer to a question of, you know, what do we do with this knowledge? It's part of the human existence to find out more about ourselves and our origins and where we might be going.
Bill Kurth is with us from the University of Iowa. Now joining us also, Roger Lonius is the Associate Director of Collections and Curatorial Affairs at the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. Roger, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Can I hand you that question, too, for your perspective on Mike's question from Des Moines? What's in it for us? Why should we care? Why should we fund it?
Well, fundamentally, the answer given already was excellent. I would add to that in terms of scientific knowledge. I think the fundamental question to be resolved for, at least in terms of space, is are we alone in the universe? I really want to know the answer to that question. And does that life exist in the solar system? Might it exist as microbial bodies on Mars or underneath the surface of Mars? Might it be in this ocean that was spoken about on Europa that's covered with ice? I'd really like to know the answer to that. And then, of course, beyond the solar system, is there a Goldilocks planet out there, a little blue and white marble hanging in the blackness of space that may have individuals on it that we might even be able to communicate with? That is really exciting stuff, and it costs almost nothing. The entire NASA budget is about 0.4% of the entire federal budget. I mean, we ought to be able to afford that to kind of answer those core questions beyond that scientific objective.
Okay.
The technologies that are pursued are useful in all kinds of other arenas.
River to River listeners, what would you like to see NASA do, achieve in the next couple of decades? 1-866-780-9100. One of these things that Roger mentioned or something entirely different. River to River at iowapublicradio.org is our email. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or find us on Facebook. Roger, now I know you've done some looking into public opinion on and perceptions of U.S. Spaceflight. What were the major findings you had when you looked at that question?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. And in the context of human spaceflight, we began doing this in the context of the Cold War in the 1960s, and we've continued it up to the present, but the environment has sharply changed. So are the reasons that we began it still valid reasons? Yes, we want to discover, and everybody recognizes that as an important objective, but at what cost? And so what we find traditionally, it's a little bit like the Platte River. Some of the folks in Nebraska love to talk about the Platte being a mile wide and an inch deep. That's sort of support for human spaceflight. It's a mile wide. You talk to anybody about it, and yes, they like it. They think it's great. But if you ask them the question, should we be spending, name the amount that you wish to spend on human spaceflight versus spending that same amount on some other program, often the space exploration agenda loses in that context.
So what is the state of federal funding of NASA space exploration right now? How can you sum that up, Roger?
It's a very tiny amount of money, less than a penny out of your tax dollar goes to NASA and space activities. So in that context, there's a belief that it's expensive, but the reality is it's not.
Mm-hmm. If people voice their support of it in sort of an abstract opinion poll, but then say, well, the dollars and cents just aren't behind these opinions, what is the cause of that mismatch? Is it just poor education, poor awareness about what the value of these programs is?
Yeah, much of it is built upon kind of a not terribly engaged public who are worried about other things, and not necessarily very well informed. on that, and that's nobody's fault really. But there's very few people who follow any public program in great detail, regardless of what it happens to be. And spaceflight and NASA are clearly in that category.
Mm-hmm. Now, we just had on this program just last week, as a matter of fact, one of the astronauts who spent some time in the space station. But I get the sense that if you would poll people in America, and I wonder how many would even know we had a space station and have had one around. Would you not agree with that, Roger, that some people might not even know that, many people?
Well, I think there's some, obviously, who wouldn't know that there's a space station. But I think most people know at some level there's this activity underway. They don't know the details.
Right, right. So they don't know the details, and they don't know perhaps the relevancy for their lives, which is what?
Well, I mean, the relevancy is also about pushing back the frontiers of knowledge. That's clearly a key piece of this. There is very practical technological things that impact our lives on a daily basis that result from investments that we've made in space technology. And you can start with almost any piece of technology that you've got that's kind of high technology stuff, electronics or whatever. Some of that was pushed by investment in space activities.
Steve has an email from Toledo. He writes, "It seems to me some of the most spectacular discoveries have been made with our space-based telescopes." Mm-hmm. Steve writes, he hopes that continues. Perhaps you can tell us, Roger, what is the difference between, you know, a space-based telescope and sending a probe out there? And Bill probably will have an answer for us too here. Why should we need both?
Well, both they each fulfill a different task. Probes going to various parts of the solar system are engaged in exploration in those particular areas only. So when we sent Galileo to Jupiter, or Cassini that's currently at Saturn, or New Horizons that's on its way to Pluto in the Kuiper Belt right now, they're going to focus on those particular regions of the solar system, and they're going to, and have already, expanded our knowledge of those areas. But they're not going to focus beyond those particular regions. Something like the Hubble Space Telescope, which has had this stunning career of now more than 20 years, is focused beyond the solar system by and large. It does take pictures of planets on occasion, but mostly it's a cosmological approach, and it's looking at other galaxies and other places. Mm-hmm. And the knowledge associated with that has been stunning. There are efforts to replace the Hubble Space Telescope with a new generation of technology, the James Webb Space Telescope, that should be launched in the next few years.
Now, we have that level of discussion from something orbiting the Earth outside of our atmosphere, but orbiting the Earth to explore space. Mm-hmm. We have the probes out there. Bill Kurth, let me ask you about this. When we talk about manned versus unmanned spacecraft, there's been that long-standing debate. Where do you stand in that debate? Should we get more bang for our buck in terms of what scientific information from unmanned spacecraft, don't we?
Well, I certainly would agree with that statement. I think the important thing here is to ask yourself why we go into space. As a kid, I enjoyed watching the astronauts go into space. I think I was in second grade when Alan Shepard was launched. I watched the first man step on the moon. I was in awe about Apollo 8 orbiting the moon for the first time. You know, it's an adventure. Our experience, and we've flown a couple of missions on the space shuttle from the University of Iowa, is that if you want to do science, you do everything you can to minimize the amount of work the astronaut has to do for you, because the astronaut's got other more important things to do. And if you look at a budget for a manned space program, if you have $100 to spend on that and you're spending less than $99 on making sure that astronaut gets back safely, are you doing the right thing?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, science, I would not argue the point that if we had a geologist on Mars that could walk around and pick up the right rocks, that would be an ideal thing to do. But There's so much more that we can do now and not wait for decades to get the capability of sending a man there.
Just expensive to maintain this biological system inside a craft.
Right. We could go there with robotic spacecraft and pick up samples and bring it back to labs at Earth and accomplish that science much more easily. I do have one other comment to make about the funding for the space program, because I've had people ask me, why are we sending all that money into space? Well, it turns out we don't send a single dollar into space. It all gets spent here on Earth, and it's funding research and development. It's paying high-paying salaries. The investment that we make in space is actually investments that we make here in the United States and developing our capabilities to produce more advanced technology items for use here on Earth.
Roger Lonius, we have just a few minutes left, about 5 minutes left. I wanted to get into privatization of space. NASA has changed its strategy recently to encourage commercial space development. We've heard of successful launches, for instance, by SpaceX, the formation of an increasing number of commercial space development firms. How will space be shaped by commercial development and privatization in the future?
Yeah, I think we're on a verge of a new age in space when it comes to this arena. And one of the things that's happened, and NASA basically accomplished this in the context of a long history of kind of exploration, where you have the explorers that are largely government-funded, the Lewis and Clark expedition comes to mind, who go out and kind of blaze the trail, and they're followed by entrepreneurs and others who want to do other types of things there, kind of turning the area into the normal realm of human activity. We've done that now with low Earth orbit. And the idea is that, and it's a good one, that more private sector firms can engage in space activities for profit by selling services to government organizations or to private citizens or to companies or whomsoever, and freeing NASA from its from the shackles of having to deal with low Earth orbit activities to focus beyond to cislunar and translunar space.
Mm-hmm. Why not make it completely privatized? Does the government need to be there anymore?
Well, the government's always going to have a role, and that role will recede into the background, but it'll certainly be present in the context of regulations, in the context of setting certain types of rules. There will be very public good type activities that'll take place in Earth orbit no matter what, weather satellites, types of communication, GPS, and so on. So the government's not leaving the realm altogether. But it's going to be changing its structure, I think, in the next decade or 20 years.
Let's come full circle, talk a little bit about Voyager here at the conclusion, because on Voyager is a golden record that we've heard about. And Roger, you mentioned one of the big questions, of course, for all of us, is there other life out there? We have a little recording we want to hear at the close of this program, one of the recordings on that golden record. Now, Bill Kurth, Voyager 1 will continue how long with power?
Well, we think we'll have to start powering down the instruments that are currently obtaining data from the interstellar medium starting in about 2020. And by 2025, we'll be able to operate the spacecraft, but with no science instruments. And if we really wanted to track the spacecraft, we could probably collect just the engineering data for another 10 years beyond that. Mm-hmm. After that, the spacecraft will be in orbit in the Milky Way, and they'll probably do that until some cataclysmic event such as the Milky Way running into Andromeda or something like that.
Okay, and we put this golden record on there, this artifact on there, with the idea that it may be discovered by whom?
We don't know. but I think the it's as much a hope as anything else that to think about ourselves as coming from this pale blue dot and going into space and realizing that maybe somebody will actually find this record and be able to learn something about us, I think is an extraordinary concept.
Roger Lonius, we have about a minute before we have to go, and we want to hear a little bit of something on this record. But can you tell us what's on this record and how we represent ourselves in Voyager?
Oh, absolutely. There are greetings from many nations in different languages on there. There's a sampling of music. There's a sampling of imagery. It's stunning in a lot of ways. It has everything from Beethoven to Chuck Berry on it. And there's a famous Saturday Night Live skit that was done in the 70s in which they reported. Obviously not a real news report, that they had received word back that they should send more Chuck Berry.
That's very good. I want to thank you very much, both of you, for joining us. Roger Lonius is with the Smithsonian Institution's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. Roger, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Bill Kurth is with us, research scientist at the University of Iowa's Department of Physics and Astronomy. And thank you, Bill.
It's been a pleasure.
One of the recordings we picked out, Ben Stanton picked this out, our producer, Wedding Song from Peru, that is on that golden record. Let's listen to that uninterrupted after I thank our producer, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This off the golden record aboard Voyager 1, now in interstellar space.
Du hast kaum Milch von mir.